It gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor John Braithwaite, who is known to many of you as a pioneer in this field. His early book, Crime, Shame and Reintegration, was hugely important and significant. And we've gone on to work extremely practically in the last recent period in Bougainville and on East Timor and the Solomon Islands around reconciliation and peace building. And just about sort of 20-year comparative study of peace building, which is fascinating. I don't think it goes on for 20 years. Is it the last 20 years?
It's going to go.
We're nine years into it.
Oh, you're only fantastic. Good. Well, that'll be good to hear about.
Don't worry about my age.
No, you're not. You can pass the back one. So, John, thank you very much indeed for joining us here and for kicking off this symposium. We're very glad to have you. And you're going to talk about what place for the F word.
Good. Thanks, Hugo and Myra. It's always lovely to visit Cambridge and be in the Oxford. And oh, gosh. I don't have jet lag as an excuse. I've actually been in Belfast. So what I meant to say, to be in Oxford and be in the embrace of these beautiful colleges, I always love being in these spaces, and in Cambridge ones too, I'd have to say. And thank you, Hugo and Myra, for that kind introduction, and to our sponsors, Three. In 1998, there was an important case called the Clotworthy case in the Court of Appeal, which is the highest court in New Zealand. There had been an offence dealt with in the district courts by Justice Thorburn, who's a famously progressive New Zealand judge interested in restorative justice. There are many of them, as it happens in New Zealand. And this was a very serious assault indeed, a knife attack on a gentleman who was standing at a bus stop. He was stabbed many times, his lung was punctured. He had been suffering epilepsy for a lot of his life. The epilepsy recurred. It was lucky that it wasn't a murder. When it came to the trial process, the victim asked that a restorative justice conference be held. And at that, and Judge Thorburn, as often happens in New Zealand cases, agreed to send the case away to restorative justice conference, and then the conference came back and reported on their deliberations. At the conference, the victim said that the victim had been in prison himself and was sharply aware of the damage that imprisonment could do to human beings, and wanted the grace of not sending, of taking steps that would prevent this human being from spending a long time in prison. So that was that particular kind of gift of forgiveness was one of the things that was very important for the victim, as he articulated it in the case. There was also a practical thing. One of the knife wounds was a scarring slash wound to his face. And plastic surgery wasn't covered, I understand, by the New Zealand Criminal Compensation Program at that time. And the bill for the plastic surgery would be $15,000, which the victim did not have. As it happened, the offender had a steady job with a reasonable income, and so was in a position to pay a significant portion of that $15,000 in a down payment and then pay off the plastic surgeon over a reasonable period of time. So it would agree that was one of a number of reparation items. There was some community service items agreed, and a proposal that there would therefore be a non-custodial sentence, also an apology from the offender, of course. So Judge Thorburn more or less went along with that. He imposed a 2-year prison sentence that was suspended, which means that he would not serve the time unless he committed another offence during that 2 years. Prosecutor appealed, and on appeal to the Court of Appeal, the judges reversed the decision and imposed a rather lengthy prison sentence, and also reversed the payment for the plastic surgery. They really had to do that because he would not be in a position to be able to pay for the plastic surgery being in prison. It seems like a negative sort of setback case for restorative justice, but actually, along the way, the judges did find that restorative justice was a principle of sentencing in New Zealand, and that's the sense and one of the senses in which it's a very, very important case. When on my rare occasions when I teach law students, well, I actually do that every year, and I usually describe the Clotworthy case to them and ask them their opinion on who decided it correctly, Justice Thorburn or the Court of Appeal. And then sometimes I hold back for a while another bit of information about the case, which was that the victim committed suicide soon after the case was reversed. And most law students, a healthy majority of law students, think that the Court of Appeal decided it correctly, mainly on the basis of this was a serious crime, equal punishment for equal wrong kind of arguments are the arguments that the law students usually articulate. And then I put my point of view to them on why I think Justice Thorburn decided the case correctly. Now, in the judgment of the Court of Appeal, they did not find that Clotworthy was a dangerous person who would be a risk to the community because he would commit this kind of offence again. Nor did they use a just deserts kind of argument. He should go to prison because this is simply what he deserves. Rather, it was a deterrence argument. We need to deter. The court needs to make decisions that deter serious violence. And secondly, the court needs to give a message, a moral education message, that the community takes very serious violence that verges on homicide seriously. And the way we take it seriously is by imposing a sentence that's proportionate to that seriousness, to give that educative message. Now, when I argue with the students and try to dissuade them from their majority view, I say, well, you know, there's not much evidence. You know, we will be discussing, and I'll come back later in the lecture to whether there's evidence on the effectiveness of forgiveness. But in these debates, a lot of burden is often placed on the innovation in the system. What's the evidence that forgiving, you know, this victim thinks forgiveness will be, this victim wants to give the gift of forgiveness, but will it really, really work? Will there be reoffending that we need to mop up? I say in response that, well, there's not much evidence that more severe deterrence in severe and seriously violent cases is effective. It's not the case that societies that impose longer prison terms for serious violent crimes are more effective in deterring violence. Nor is it the case that societies that impose heavier prison terms on serious violence more effectively communicate the message that violence is wrong. That is to say, I don't think there is evidence to show that in the United States, for example, where sentences for serious violence offences, that those heavy sentences have been successful in persuading citizens of the United States to think that murder and serious assaults are matters of greater concern than they are in my own society or in your society, where the punishments are, on average, are much lower for those kinds of offences. So that's the empirical case. It's not that deterrence and moral education don't work at all as functions of criminal punishment. We know when there are police strikes, we know when nothing happens in an entire area of criminality that you get more criminality as a result of a total absence of deterrence and a total absence of our legal system confronting the wrongness of the crime through its moral educative messages. I'm not wanting to argue that. But at the margin, imposing more punishment, increasing the average penalties in a particular case is not going to make any difference. You know, the empirical claims of the Court of Appeal, I argue, aren't very persuasive. But more fundamentally than that, it's important to listen to the voice of the victim. Equal punishment for equal wrongs by offenders is fine, but we should have equal concern for the justice claims of victims and other stakeholders in the injustice as well. So this victim in the Clotworthy case is a stakeholder. There's something that the victim wants out of the case. Why would we ignore that claim for consideration of the victim's justice concerns in order to follow an equality of treatment argument that applies only to the offender side of the equation? So that's that part of the moral argument that I put to the students, that the principle should not be equal punishment for equal wrongs. It should be equal concern for the justice claims of all stakeholders in the injustice. And then I used to ask them to vote again. And I stopped doing that because the last time I did it, more of them voted for the Court of Appeal than was the case before my incredibly persuasive arguments that I put to them. But it's a good case for us all to ask ourselves how we would decide it, and what does that tell us about how we think about the centrality of forgiveness in the criminal justice system. I think that victims in a case like that should be seen as having a right to forgive. In Islamic law, thinks about forgiveness more in that kind of way, in terms of a right to forgive. So that I've been doing work with Ali Gohar, who is the most distinguished leader of restorative justice innovation in Pakistan. And in many cases of repeat revenge violence, when there's a restorative settlement in a traditional jirga, the jirga will ask that the perpetrator of a murder will be released from prison. And in the part of Pakistan, which is the northwest on the border with Pakistan, where Ali works, usually or perhaps almost always, the judge will agree with that submission, which is when it is a consensus submission from the jirga, and someone who may have been serving a long prison sentence for murder may be let out after a short period of months. So that's the practical edge. You know, that's That's a real difference between their criminal justice system and ours. And again, my moral intuitions go to finding the Pakistan justice system's way of responding to a situation like that. In the Clotworthy case, Ali can correct me if I'm wrong, I would assume that a Pakistan judge in the Pakhtun Belt in the northwest of Pakistan would have acceded to the victim's wishes to get the compensation, the plastic surgery, and to be able to give the gift of forgiveness. International human rights law is often criticised for being a Western construction, as being generated from the nations which are the old Christendom of Europe plus North America, and the response is usually no, that's not right. All sorts of nations vote for at the United Nations for international human rights instruments, and that's true, but at the foundation, the framework was very much crafted by those predominantly Christian nations. So those from non-Christian nations who say, there are aspects of it with which we're not totally comfortable, are a legitimation problem for international human rights law, even though it is the case that most nations, the majority of people, in most respects, with regard to most human rights standards, really do go along with them. But they, unfortunately, given that that is the case, are seen as having this Western construction. And that's one reason why I think it might be a good idea to have an explicitly, not explicitly Muslim, but a reform to international human rights law that says that victims should be granted a right to forgive, should they choose to forgive, and to say that because Islamic law has a more radical commitment to that right to forgive than Western criminal law has, here is an area where we have changed in response to the plurality of ways of dealing with serious criminal cases around the world. And I think then international human rights law might have more international legitimacy than it does beyond the West. And there aren't many ideas, there aren't many areas where there are productive opportunities of this kind. Why is there a productive opportunity space here? Because in the West, we do have a global movement for restorative justice. Christians also believe in the importance of forgiveness. They might generally not go so far as being wanting to grant a right to forgive. They would have all sorts of concerns about what if forgiveness is granted in circumstances where this person really is dangerous. I don't see, and many other concerns, I mean, that particular one I don't see as a problem, because there's just a clash of rights in that circumstances. There's the right of other potential victims to be protected from crime, and judges appropriately would need to balance that right of the community to security and safety of its persons against the right of a victim who wishes to forgive. I've argued that restorative justice values can be sort of split into three sorts. First, constraining values, maximising values, and emergent values of restorative justice. By constraining values, I won't talk about constraining values much, but it means things like legally binding upper limits on punishment. So for this kind of punishment, you can't impose more than that level of punishment. Equal concern for the justice claims of all stakeholders in the injustice is another example of a constraining value. On my argument, justice enterprises should be constrained by that equals concern and should not privilege equality of punishment for offenders. Accountability, appealability is another one, and the whole architecture of international human rights law and victims' rights as applied to criminal justice. Maximising values are values that we should set out to actively encourage in restorative justice process. So restoration of human dignity would be something we should seek to maximise in a restorative justice process. Restoration of human safety would be another. Transformation of relationships. For me, the most fundamental one is freedom. We should be seeking to maximise the amount of freedom in the world. That's the sort of the civic republican perspective that Philip Pettit and I in our work bring to this stuff. But then I distinguish emergent restorative justice values from maximising ones. With emergent restorative justice values, of which forgiveness is one of the most important, I argue that you don't actively encourage people to realise those values. That by actively encouraging people to realise them, you're less likely to realise them. And there are lots of things like that in the world. If we actively encourage ourselves to be spontaneous, we won't be very spontaneous. And the reason that seeking to maximise forgiveness or apology is another, to seeking to maximise the amount of apology that occurs is a bad idea, on my argument, is that apology, forgiveness are gifts. And if we drag them out of people, they will have less emotional power because their emotional power inheres in that property of them being a gift. So there are a number of emergent restorative justice values on my account: remorse, apologies, censure of the act, and forgiveness are the important ones. So that censure of the act is not something we set out to maximise. So that's a different way of thinking about it from the Court of Appeal in New Zealand in Clotworthy as well. So that, you know, reintegrative shaming theory argues that if you actively set out to shame, for example, through shaming penalties, that in fact will be counterproductive because it will be interpreted as stigmatising shaming, and stigmatising shaming is a form of shame that actually makes crime worse according to the theory. But if we have a criminal justice system that doesn't constitute something like serious assault or rape as shameful, we will be a society with a lot of rape and a lot of violence day to day. So the system must accomplish it, but the argument is that if we have a well-designed criminal justice system, we will have enough emergent constitution of the shamefulness of crime and a number of these other good things as well. Well, there are folk who are going to be at the symposium who are really going to argue against that view, so that's going to be a terrific conversation that we look forward to. But the position that I've articulated in the literature is that we should never urge a person to forgive for those reasons. That's not to say that we can't think about how to design restorative justice processes in such a way that they create spaces where forgiveness is possible rather than crushed. And of course, that's one of the reasons why I'm describing the Clotworthy case as a case where their existing legal system crushes forgiveness. One thing I've learned about restorative justice, I mean, I used to have a firmly democratic view of who should be included in the restorative justice circle. The people who should be in a restorative justice circle are those who are stakeholders in the injustice in some way that can be articulated in a way that persuades other participants in the circle that they really ought to be there because they're a relative of one of the players, because they have some practical support to offer, because they're a victim or an indirect victim or associated supporting the perpetrator. What I've learned, I think, from observing, I guess, hundreds of restorative justice processes now, is that where there's a person with spiritual depth in the circle, it all goes better. Philosophically, in both East Asian restorative justice, in terms of a Confucian philosophy of justice, where Confucius would say you have to have those people in the justice process who are the kind of people who will provide a superior example to others. So they have this less democratic, more elitist view, and so do most of the world's indigenous people. So the peoples of the Pacific, there's a couple of dozen languages in the Pacific that we use the word mana, and there are many African languages that use the word Ubuntu. So that people from these African and Austronesian cultures, language groups in the Pacific, would, see Ubuntu and mana as meaning something a bit similar in this context, that you must bring to the justice process not only the stakeholders, but this person of profound spiritual depth. And one of the things that person brings is kindness, empathy, but I would summarise all that by saying a deep love of other human beings, and that love becomes infectious, and the infectiousness of that love by the person who provides a superior example of spiritual depth will create, and it does create, an environment where forgiveness is more likely to happen. So there are practical things like that where we can draw on Indigenous wisdom to learn how to have restorative justice processes that have more forgiveness. Forgiveness education is also important in that regard, so that in schools it seems to me to be a good thing to have the kinds of forgiveness education that go on in many societies, including this one, where children, it's one of the things that children discuss during their education, the benefits they can get, the benefits that others can get when forgiveness is a way of responding to one of our daily hurts. Nathan Harris, one of my colleagues at ANU, he found this very interesting result in our Canberra restorative justice experiments, where we're randomly assigning 1,400 cases to a standard criminal trial and to restorative justice. What he found was that in the restorative justice circle, there was no impact on whether remorse was experienced by the perpetrator in terms of what the attitude to the offence was of a police officer in the room or any other agent of the state in the room. This goes to the irrelevance, I would say, near irrelevance of moral disapproval by agents of the state like judges at the micro level in a criminal justice process. That's not to say there's some important macro relevance of moral education through the utterances of judges, but the utterances of agents of the state do not move people in criminal justice processes, nor do those even of our friends and family members with whom we don't have a deep relationship of trust and love. It's only Nathan's finding was that it's only those who we have the deepest relationship of love with, when they communicate to us effectively, I really love you as a person, but the act that you perpetrated here was something that was just terrible, and that we have to come to terms with, and we have to repair the harm. When those who are in very close loving relationships with the offender think that way, are perceived as thinking that way, then the offender is likely to come to the view that indeed what they did was shameful, to experience remorse and to want to repair the harm after acknowledging the shame. Nathan hates it when I call that his all you need is love result. And my kids, when I've given lectures on the love thing, which is a theme here today, I sometimes have, in the past, have asked them to comment on what they think of the lecture, and they've said, pretty good, Dad, but cut the hippie stuff about the love. But I'm not going to follow their advice today. I'll run amok with the theme by moving on to Martin Luther King's view about love and justice. He says, justice is love correcting that which revolts against love. Another famous quote of his is, power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice. Justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands in the way of love. And these are views that I want to subscribe to in the final parts of this lecture. If Martin Luther King were alive today, if he'd been alive at the time of September 11, 2001, I have little doubt that he would have been opposed to the quickfire invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, not just because they were dumb responses. I mean, they were dumb responses. I mean, in the case of Afghanistan, which most people in the West supported the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, in fact, an overwhelming majority of people did. But the debate was so impoverished, particularly on the offer by the Dalai Omar was sort of pushed into this view, but by the Taliban leadership, by the Shura, to enter into a conversation about handing over Osama bin Laden to perhaps Saudi Arabia, to some court in which they could have confidence. That was rejected out of hand, but there was no conversation about that option with the Taliban regime. We know now very clearly that they were of the view. I mean, why wouldn't they be of the view that this man, Osama bin Laden, was going to bring down everything that they had stood for and had been trying to build? And indeed, they were right that that happened. So they were right to give that a shot. But it was the West that didn't respond at all. But it was also dumb. The quality of the conversation that we had at that time, because even if there was not a willingness to do that, you know, the George Bush view, you'll recall, at the time was, if you're a supporter, you know, you're either with us or against us. And the Taliban was against us because they were harbouring Al-Qaeda, so that they are clearly in the enemy camp, and we don't have negotiations with terrorists. So, but even if they had that view, why didn't we have a conversation about the more limited option of, instead of invading Afghanistan, of doing what was ultimately done in respect of Osama bin Laden, that is, a special forces strike. At that time, up to the invasion, it was actually known where he was. It was the announcement of the invasion that put him quickly activated a plan that he had in place to escape into Pakistan. So I think if Martin Luther King had been alive, he would have been promoting that kind of conversation as a dissenter in the way he did with the Vietnam War. But more than that, he would be identifying what the response was in respect of both Afghanistan and Iraq at that time as being an invasion was the only option, at least in respect of Afghanistan, because the desire for revenge was so strong. We had to do something, and we wanted to do something that was proportionately violent to the terrible evil that was done to the United States. So I'm arguing that we might have done better. We might have done less damage to ourselves in Iraq and Afghanistan if our response in late 2001 had been motivated by love for the people of Afghanistan and love for the people of Iraq. And love for the people of Afghanistan and Iraq was also not part of our conversation. With that philosophy that Martin Luther King had, it certainly would have been the way he would have talked about it. And, of course, our love for other stakeholders in the injustice that was 9/11. In a better world, in a more restorative world, we might have even seen the families of the victims of September 11 going to Pakistan to meet, going to Afghanistan to meet with what we now call the Quetta Shura, to sit down with them and say why and how they have suffered and expose the people of Afghanistan to the consequences of their harbouring this terrorist organisation. Robert Enright has, of course, done a lot of, and his colleagues have done a lot of empirical work about why forgiveness is good for people in personal relations as well as international relations, helping victims to become healthier, to transcend the mental health deficits, the post-traumatic stress symptoms that come so often of being a victim of crime. The evidence is thin on the effectiveness of forgiveness in preventing crime. But a much ignored piece of research, of which I'm a co-author and therefore which I'll promote now, is by Eliza Ahmed and myself, that was published in the Australian New Zealand Journal of Criminology, which no one outside of Australia and New Zealand reads, but I believe in publishing there because we have a local scholarly community that is a vibrant community for developing ideas of restorative justice. And so I like to publish some of what I regard as the best work we're doing in the local journal. I think this was the case. It was a large sample of 1,875 school children from Bangladesh, which is the home country of Eliza. And what it found was that children who experienced reintegrative shaming in their socialisation, in their home and school and peer life, were less likely to engage in bullying. So it was supportive of reintegrative shaming theory, and more importantly, it was supportive of or helping to develop the shame acknowledgement theory for which Eliza Ahmed has become renowned since that time. That is to say, you will be less likely to be a bully if you know and that what you do is acknowledge shame and discover ways of repairing the harm and moving on from the shame. You are less likely to be a bully if you do that. You are more likely to be a bully if you displace shame, for example, by accusing your accusers. But the predicted empirical effects of those three shame acknowledgement variables, reintegrative shaming, shame acknowledgement, and shame displacement, while they were all very encouraging, the really powerful effect in that study was a forgiveness effect. It was twice, it had twice the explanatory power of reintegrative shaming. That is to say that children who in their families have had the experience of being forgiven and who learnt to forgive were less likely to be bullies in their day-to-day school school lives. Unconditional forgiveness, however, has its dangers. Forgiveness needs to be embedded in rituals of shame acknowledgement, rituals of remorse. One area where we see a failure to do that in Australia is we have a big problem of sons perpetrating violence against their mothers. And when sons assault their mothers tend to be very forgiving, tend to almost never take the case to the criminal justice system, perhaps because they blame themselves as the mothers of this boy. But what we get as a result of that is forgiveness without anything else accompanying it. And that's a problem, I want to argue. That's a way forgiveness can actually be counterproductive, because the boy is getting the message that the violence is okay, I was just forgiven like that, problem over, move on, and his violence will recur. And we know that that's likely to be the case as well from the general child development literature, for example, the Patterson studies that show that parents who just natter at their children are more likely to have violent and delinquent children. That is to say, if mum or dad observed their son hitting his sister in the dining room, just walks past them on the way to the kitchen and says, "Stop hitting your sister," and doesn't even stop to check that he actually does stop hitting his sister, that's a very ineffective socialisation practice, which will result in an escalation of a violent biography. So in a case like mother-son violence, we need a restorative justice ritual, I would argue, within which the forgiveness which will inevitably occur in that relational context can connect up to some other things, where other members of the family will articulate their concern about the safety of the mother, and where practical things for safety planning for the mother will occur as a result. I need to wind up, don't I? Practical safety planning stuff needs to be motivated. That's what confronting the wrongfulness of the deed is about in injustice processes. So we do want violent offenders to experience shame without that being accomplished by directly shaming them. We want to have a conversation about why, in this case, the mother has been harmed and is suffering so deeply emotionally as well as a result of such a terrible thing occurring. I've just been in Belfast where I was talking about an interesting case of that kind there, where Community Restorative Justice Northern Ireland had dealt with a son against a mother case, and where they'd put the son into anger management program. He had a drug problem, into a drug rehabilitation program, where the mother had been connected up to support from a shelter, who were ready to receive her and respond to her, depending what her needs were. But more importantly, and here's the community these are community-based restorative justice programs, not state ones, in Belfast. She had four phone numbers that she could call at any time. And, you know, so these are not people who are in some office somewhere in downtown Belfast, but someone very close, just around the corner, and someone not that they can call 9 to 5, but they can call 24 hours a day because of the strong relational connection. So the community restorative justice thing, I think, when motivated by the right kind of emotional dynamics, can deliver superior preventive practical help. Suicide, in cases like this, is, to my mind, the way I read the evidence, a more important concern than the violence itself. Suicide by mothers and other family members when this sort of thing is going on. There's just been published in 2014 in the Journal of Experimental Criminology an article by Lawrence Sherman and Heather Harris, which is a 23-year follow-up of the Minnesota domestic violence experiment, showing that those who are subject to an arrest by the police criminal justice response to an incident randomly assigned to that response to criminal justice had a 64% greater chance of being dead 23 years on than those who were randomly assigned to another, you know, more supportive kinds of support process. And for black victims, that was 100% higher. Suicide across the board is a bigger concern than crime. And that's also why I think the Clotworthy case is a very interesting one to focus on. The criminal justice system is an important cause of suicide and of homicide. I mean, we say we send people to prison to protect the community from things like homicide, but the fact is that people in prisons in this country have 5 times the probability of being murdered than people outside the prison. It's just the kind of people that get murdered who are different. And similarly, there's 5 times the risk of suicide in this country for people who are in prison. In the UK, there are 18 suicides for every homicide. So we do more good or harm in the criminal justice system by getting the impact we have on suicide right than we do harm or good by getting the impact we have on homicide right. That's part of my argument here, that self-harm is a more important consequence of domination in domestic relationships generally as well than crimes of violence. Hence, criminal lawyers who care about justice should not be myopically focused on crime and its punishment or crime and its prevention as they go about the business of being criminal lawyers. We can do better with a criminal law which, as King put it, would transform itself to, I quote him again, a justice that is love, correcting that which revolts against love. Thank you. Thank you.